Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Woody Holton's an old buddy of mine. I met him through this show. He was at the University of Richmond, where we broadcast over WVTF's Radio IQ service, and he's a fan of the show. Thanks, Woody. We appreciate that. And one day he sent me an email, and he said, hey, it's 2013. This was several years ago. It's 2013, and did you realize that it's been 100 years this year since Charles Beard published his groundbreaking work, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States? And much to my embarrassment, I had to say, well, no, Woody, I didn't realize we were celebrating that particular centenary. But now that you mention it, why don't we go ahead and celebrate with a roundtable discussion? And so a little while later, Woody and I and another historian you've probably heard of called Gordon Wood, we all sat down and we talked about that remarkable, groundbreaking work, how it's been treated subsequently, and of course, along the way, we got Woody's gloss on Charles Beard. And I detected then that Woody was a guy who was interested in the democratic aspect of the origins of the Constitution. That he's a historian who doesn't just want to talk about history at the heights, all the dead white guys who were sort of running things from the top, people like Hamilton and Washington and Madison, and in other words, the people we talk about all the time. He wanted to talk about the common folk. And that was intriguing to me because I guess like most lawyers, like most law professors, like most people who study the Constitution, I'd sort of fallen into the trap of ignoring the great number of Americans who are just ordinary folk out there who did participate in that ratification process of the Constitution. And so I've been meaning to talk to Woody again for a while, and I'm glad to say that today we're going to do that. And we're specifically going to focus on a book he wrote some years ago called Unruly Americans. How's that for a title? Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution.
I'm Woody Holton, and I teach at the University of South Carolina, where I'm the McCausland Professor of History. And my specialty is the American Revolution, and in particular, the people that you don't find on the back of the $2 bill, but probably should, because Native Americans and African Americans and women and small farmers influenced those one percenters who were there to write the Declaration of Independence in 1776 and the Constitution in 1787.
Well, wait a second. What do you say? You're a historian, but I thought history was all about rich, dead white guys.
It used to be, but I'm part of a large group of historians these days who believe that history does happen from the top down sometimes, but it also sometimes happens from the bottom up. And one way to express that is to say that if ordinary Americans had been as passive as the history books sometimes imagine them being, we wouldn't have a Bill of Rights, because the Founding Fathers did not inscribe a Bill of Rights into the Constitution. They didn't think we needed one. But ordinary people said to them, and a lot of elite Americans as well, said to them, we're not going to give you your Constitution unless you give us a Bill of Rights. So the Bill of Rights is a classic example of an important, and many of us think one of the most valuable aspects of our American system that came from below, not from above.
You're inspiring me here, Woody. I'm thinking I'm going to have to have Wayne start playing a little Aaron Copland in the background, fanfare for the common man. And
right.
So we're going to champion the cause of the common man and perhaps even the common woman here. And I should confess that you and I, of course, go back a number of years, and I had a sense for all those years that this was your perspective, because you very kindly contacted me some years ago and alerted me to the then 100th anniversary of Charles Beard's remarkable book, all about the founding of the Constitution, the writing of the Constitution. It was called An Economic Interpretation of the History of the An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. And it had its centennial in 2013. And you and I and Gordon Wood had a really interesting discussion about that. And it was during that discussion about Charles Beard's remarkable book that I started getting some hints about your perspective on this and about how important the common people were and how the people at the top were not always necessarily happy to have the participation of the common people. And I've been really intrigued by that ever since then. And it was only more recently, however, that our executive producer, Wayne Winkler, heard you on public radio, heard you on a marvelous show called Backstory, discussing that very concept and in referring to a book of yours that I believe, did it win a National Book Award?
It should have. No, it was a finalist. A great book about the CIA was the winner. But I got to go to the party.
You got to go to the party. Tremendous. And that book back in 07 was called Unruly Americans. What a great title it was. And Wayne was so thrilled by that interview. And we're both big fans of the show. And it airs on WETS, our home station, that he immediately emailed me and said, oh, we've got to get Woody back on. And, you know, this would fit squarely in. An extended discussion of Unruly Americans would be a great feature for us. And so that's why we're here today. We want to hear more about this rabble back in the day that had such an effect on our constitutional history.
I think it's an exciting story because for me, one of the messages of it is it's sort of empowering for us today at a time when so many people say you can't fight City Hall. You think, well, gosh, if these other Americans from the 1700s could take on the founding fathers and influence them, well, then Clinton and Trump and Obama and all these other politicians that we're dealing with today, well, maybe we can influence them.
Yeah, that would have been kind of a challenge, wouldn't it? Taking on George Washington. Now, that was a challenge.
It is a fascinating era to study because there are all these people that nobody's heard of today, but that really had an impact at the time on the founding fathers. For instance, Herman Husband, who had been born into the Anglican, that is the Episcopal Church, but rebelled against that and became a Quaker and kind of rebelled against that by supporting essentially the ordination of women ministers. So they kicked him out of his Quaker meeting. And then in the 1760s, farmers in North Carolina, where he lived, rebelled against establishment there over issues like high taxes and court fees. They were really against lawyers and merchants. And the lawyers and merchants, supported by the governor, sent an army that suppressed this rebellion, killed a bunch of guys, hanged a bunch of others. And Herman Husband escaped with the wonderful alias to escape death to Pennsylvania, where 20 years later, he was a participant in the Whiskey Rebellion. But in his early years in Pennsylvania, he became something that very few people ever became, and that is a critic of George Washington.
Mm.
And his issue with General Washington was that it goes back to how the war had been paid for. You know, we didn't have a treasury, we didn't have a government before the war, and so to pay the soldiers, they got essentially IOUs, both the officers and the soldiers did. Well, long story short, the officers held on to their payment certificates. The soldiers didn't because they couldn't. You can't eat paper, so they would sell these certificates at a fraction of the face value. And here's where Herman Husband was mad at President Washington, now President Washington, that Washington supported levying heavy taxes to pay off these bonds, not only to the officers, which Washington was a real advocate for his fellow officers, but also for the speculators who had bought up the soldiers' bonds at a fraction of their face value. And so we're going to levy high taxes to pay off the 1%, basically. And guess where the money's going to come from? Farmers, which is another word for saying veteran soldiers of the Revolutionary War. So the guys who had done the fighting didn't get paid. But then they got a couple of years later, shell out the money to pay off the speculators who had bought up their bonds at a fraction of the face value. That's what leads more than anything else, say, to Shays' Rebellion.
Right. And before we get to Shays' Rebellion, let's just pause because that really is striking. I'm a farmer. I go out. I risk my life. They give me nothing but scrip. I get out. My wife, my children, they're hungry. So some speculator comes and says, I'll give you, 10 cents on the dollar for your IOUs. And I say, well, I'll take that because I'm probably never going to get paid. And then a few years later, once the Constitution's adopted, George Washington and others want to levy taxes on me so that people who hold those bonds now, that is, including the speculators, can get paid off.
That's exactly right.
That is real. Well, you just explained it, but I just wanted to make sure I understood it. That really is striking. And I can understand how a farmer up in Massachusetts, which I guess we're going to next, could be really upset by that. On the other hand, the counterargument is that if you don't honor that debt, your credit as a nation is going to be bad. And you will never be a respectable nation, as Washington and Hamilton and others wanted us to be.
Yes. So there is an argument to be made for the other side. But it goes back and forth because people like Herman Husband in Pennsylvania or Daniel Shays in Massachusetts replied to that saying, well, wait a minute. The continental currency, $200 million worth of paper money paid for a lot of supplies and so forth during the war, you wrote off that debt. Why is it that you wrote off the debt to the soldiers, but once the debt is in the hands of speculators who contributed nothing to the war effort, how come suddenly we're all concerned about, we can't write off debt? I do think as a practical matter, they could have written off that debt and started over. That's called bankruptcy, and countries do go through bankruptcy, and they pull out of bankruptcy. I'm just saying that they did it with the continental currency, which wasn't owned by speculators for entirely the way the bonds almost entirely were. You could have done it for these bonds that had bought up speculators as well. But replying to that, the other side could say, well, look, soldiers, yes, you only got 10 cents on the dollar, but if it hadn't been for the speculator, you wouldn't have gotten anything at all. So I think it's a reasonable debate on either side. But, Stuart, here's where the lack of reason comes in, and that's on the part of the historians who accept one side of that argument as the only valid side.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people who were advocating for the speculators, and of course they were advocating for lots of other things as well, but the advocates for the speculators helped us have the federal constitution, which for the first time gave the federal government the authority to levy taxes, to do lots of things, to pay for a huge army that went off and fought Indians. That's the main thing the U.S. Army did during its first 10 years of existence, and to have armies to put down Shays' Rebellion, for instance. But most of all, where that federal taxation went to was paying off the bondholders. So here's my point. I think the only people that I'm really mad at in all this are the historians who come along and say one side of this argument was correct, that there aren't two sides to the argument. And what's, for me, I'll be honest with you, infuriating, is that historians flow from saying, okay, the speculators were right, the farmers were wrong, the soldiers were wrong. They flow from that to saying the farmers in demanding tax relief, not to have to pay off the bondholders, they exhibited the perils of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's really, if you ask not only Charles Beard, but Gordon Wood, they will both agree. I can speak for Gordon because he's not here and Beard because he's dead. But they'll both agree that one of the fundamental principles of the Constitution was to rein in what they called the excess of democracy that prevailed before the Constitution was written. This excess of democracy had manifested itself out in the states in the form of state legislatures passing tax relief under pressure from those ordinary farmers.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to my buddy Woody Holton about his book, Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution. Woody is challenging some of my preconceived notions, and he's telling us a fascinating tale. So stick around. And here's another constitutional quiz recorded before a live audience at the 2016 Virginia State Finals of the We the People competition.
I'm Sophia, and I'm from Lynn Haven Middle School.
I'm sorry, Sophia?
Okay.
Sophia?
Yes.
What a lovely name. Okay.
Thank you.
Do we have a quiz for Sophia?
Yeah, we do.
Do you actually want to read it?
Sure.
Okay, tremendous.
Here it comes. You ready?
Sure.
Which original colony was the last to ratify the U.S. Constitution?
Which original, so one of the original 13 colonies.
Which original colony was the last?
The last
to ratify.
One to ratify the Constitution,
all right.
Sophia.
Was it?
Here are your choices now, you have to listen.
Was it A, California? B, Mexico. C, Rhode Island.
I know.
Or D, Connecticut.
C.
C, Rhode Island? Why
yeah.
do you say that?
Because my teacher taught me that.
Your teacher? Who's your teacher?
Mr. Broglie.
I see. Do you trust your teacher?
Yes.
You do trust him?
Yeah.
You're pretty sure he's right?
Yeah.
Doug?
She's correct.
He's right. She's right. All right.
All right.
Tremendous.
And Mr. Brody.
All right.
Mr.
Back
Brody.
Here. Back here. You,
come
sir.
On down. Here we go. Look at this. That was fantastic.
Well done.
For such a great teacher, we give you the coveted U.S. Constitution playing cards.
All
it's
right.
true. There you go, sir. Congratulations. Congratulations.
Well done. Well done. There's actually kind of an interesting story there. Rhode Island was so contrary. Rhode Island was so contrary that it didn't even send anybody to the Constitutional Convention. And then after the Constitutional Convention, it refused to ratify for several years, leading people of the time to refer to it as Rogue Island. And in a story that I've not been able to confirm, but it's just so good I'm going to share it anyway, my understanding is that when the mayor of Philadelphia, actually the governor of Pennsylvania, invited the other governors to come and celebrate the bicentennial of the Constitution in 1987, when the governor of Pennsylvania issued this invitation to the other governors of the original 13 states, they all came except Rhode Island, the governor of which said, we'll show up in another few years when it's our bicentennial. I don't know if that's true, but isn't that a great story?
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm having a marvelous conversation with a marvelous fellow named Woody Holton, a professor of history at the University of South Carolina. And we're talking about the origins of the American Constitution and the often overlooked or even criticized role of common people in the adoption of that extremely important document. Now, the standard narrative seems to be, and this is the one that kind of makes Woody mad, is that the common folk didn't know what they were doing, that they had to be reined in. And maybe I've kind of bought into that, too.
I want to admit something here. I want to admit something here, Woody, is that I'm one of those people that make you so infuriated because, or at least I have been. I have been in the past because that is sort of the standard constitutional historical narrative that we needed. You know, the Articles of Confederation didn't work. The state legislature, especially places like Massachusetts or Rhode Island, were just crazy. And all the farmers would show up and just vote themselves all sort of benefits that were unsustainable. The credit of the country was going down the tube, so the economy was in a complete economic collapse. And so we needed the steady hand of somebody like Alexander Hamilton coming in and or James Madison and George Washington, who were going to champion a strong government where we were going to honor, among other things, the obligation of contract. That's why we have the Contracts Clause and where we're going to prevent these state legislatures from doing this crazy stuff. And that is the lesson that's typically drawn, at least in the superficial narratives that are given in law school classes, is that, you know, this was a necessary corrective along our constitutional history. But as you point out, these people, these supposed rabble, this mob, they had legitimate gripes. They had legitimate concerns. And what was happening was the elites were not even recognizing them. And eventually it did lead to at least some armed conflict.
That's right. Let's talk about one issue in particular that you mentioned. You know, was the economy in trouble in the 1780s? And I have the two-part reply to that. One is, yes, of course, there had just been a war. In those days, we haven't really experienced it. You know, we've experienced a huge debt because of our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But, you know, many people remember World War II as leading to the abundance of the 1950s. But the reality of the 18th century was every war leads to a recession. That's just what happened. And so when people like Alexander Hamilton said, aha, we've got a recession, this is because the farmers are destroying both their own credit ratings and our national credit rating by not paying their personal debts and by getting help from the state government to not have to pay their debts and to not have to pay the government's debt to the bondholders who bought up the war bonds. All of that's destroying credit ratings, and that's what's destroying economy. And the reply of a Daniel Shays or a Herman Husband to that is, what are you talking about? Every war in this century, that is the 1700s, has led to a recession. So is this one. And no one after the recession during the recession that came after the French and Indian War, no one said, aha, this proves that monarchy doesn't work. You see what I'm saying? They're taking a natural result of a war and using it to slur rule by ordinary people, democracy.
Well, darn it, Woody, you're making me question all the stuff I've believed for all these years. What a troublemaker
another,
you are.
Another thing to try to hammer that home, which is here's another reading of that recession.
Mm-hmm.
Other people, in responding to the Hamiltons of the world who said, oh, we got a recession because too much democracy, therefore ruined credit ratings. The other response to that is, well, let's look exactly at why we have a recession. In order to pay off the bondholders, and I got to back up and say, ultimately the Constitution does pay off the bondholders, but the states had tried to do that as well initially. And they, in order to do so, the state legislatures levied taxes that on average were three times higher than Americans had ever paid as British colonists. So you can see the irony of that Americans rebelled against the British over the issue of taxation without representation. And then once they get their own representatives, what's the first thing those representatives do? They adopt taxes that are three times higher than anyone had ever paid. Plus, they had this obsessive hatred of paper money. And so they wouldn't put money in circulation. So if you've got your government, imagine if our government do that. You know, say President Obama and Congress suddenly got together and got serious about the debt and said, you know what, we really got to pay off the U.S. debt. We're going to triple Stewart's and Woody's federal taxes. That would not only clobber your family and my family, it'll clobber the whole economy. That is precisely what most of the states did, tripled people's taxes in the 1780s. What they did was tax the economy into recession.
Wow.
So, yes, there was a terrible recession, but it was caused A, by the war, and B, ironically, not by an excess of democracy, but by a lack of democracy. That is, the state legislatures were feeling pressure, not from below. They were accused of that. But the people accusing them that were actually the ones pressuring them to levy these incredibly high taxes that I think tax the economy into recession.
That is remarkable. And we're not going to take, you know, partisan positions on, you know, tax rates. But I think most economists would probably agree if you triple taxes and if you do it suddenly, that's going to have a negative effect on economic growth, at least in the short term. But one other point, and that's called fiscal policy. And that was being done at the state level primarily. One other thing you discuss in your book, and it's something that's a little bit more difficult to understand, we might have to do a little bit more background work on this, is monetary policy. Now, we didn't have a central bank then. We certainly didn't have the Federal Reserve System then. But I believe you point out that among the many economic maladies of this era is that we had a terrible balance of payments problem. We were sending a lot of our money, gold and silver, overseas to pay for goods and services from countries that we needed to buy from. And this was essentially creating a deflation in our country. The money was leaving, and therefore a given coin that was left in the United States was worth more after a few months or maybe after a few days than it was before. And when you have a deflation like that, that also has an extremely negative effect on the economy.
I agree with you, Stuart, that it's so hard to talk about deflation. We all understand inflation. We had it in the 1980s. You see it in Zimbabwe, places like that now. But deflation, we don't have as much experience with, but that's what was happening. It's the opposite of inflation. It's kind of what happened during the Depression of the 1930s. And what happened in the 1780s was even worse than the Great Depression of the 1930s, as there was just no money in the economy. One way I like to describe it, which you're probably old enough to understand, but not sure all your listeners are, and that is, suppose, Rich, Stuart, that they tripled our taxes and then said we had to pay our taxes with green stamps. Green stamps were these things, you know, that you got back with your money 50 years ago, and there's only a few people that still have any up in their attic, and the rest of us would have to go to those people and say, please give me some green stamps, and they'd say, sure, you can have them for a price.
Right.
Well, gold and silver were just that scarce in the 1780s. Nobody had it. The few who did could charge an arm and a leg for it, and it was really breaking people. People were losing. As now, you know, if I don't pay my taxes, eventually they'll come take my stuff.
They will. And here's let's make a preliminary point here, and let's really drive this home. If I'm a farmer and I have a mortgage payment due every month of $10, let's say, and it's denominated in dollars, so every month I have to come up with dollars, but those dollars are becoming more valuable each month and more difficult for me to get, then effectively my mortgage payment goes up every month. And in fact, the total value of my debt is not getting smaller. It's getting bigger. And so as a farmer, deflation is terrible for me. And that brings us to the point of why farmers wanted states to issue paper money so that they could pay a dollar-denominated mortgage with paper money issued, for example, by the state of Massachusetts or the state of North Carolina. And that money would theoretically be printed in greater quantity, and therefore it would tend to go down in value. There would be an inflation rather than a deflation, and it would actually tend, you know, depending on how much money was printed, to lower my mortgage payment and lower my total balance to my benefit, and to, of course, to the chagrin, disappointment, dismay of the creditors. That was what these farmers wanted, because deflation was directly hurting them.
Yes, and they would say they didn't want inflation. They just wanted a steady balance, which is hard to do. It's what the Fed tries to do today between the amount of dollars and the amount of goods and services out in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
One farmer in Rhode Island expressed this really well in a newspaper essay. He said, speaking to some sort of theoretical other farmer, you know, you used to be able to bring in an ox and pay all your taxes with a single ox. But I'm sorry. You used to have to pay your taxes with half of what you get from butchering an ox, but now you got to give both halves of what you're getting from butchering your ox to the government just to pay your taxes. Not because taxes have gone up, but because of deflation. And he ended it with a really poignant line: "Pray, honest farmer, where's the other half of your ox?"
Mm.
Literally, deflation is taking property away from people, is the bottom line.
It's just a terrible thing.
Paper money seemed like a reasonable solution. Nobody was saying, oh, you know, they should just give paper money to farmers. It would either come out into the economy as payments to the bondholders. That would be a much more reasonable way to pay off the bondholders, their interest, and eventually their principal. Or the money could enter the economy through a loan office, which had worked extremely well in the colonial era in most of the colonies that had tried that. So the farmer's position was, we can get money out there without hyperinflation. Now, Alexander Hamilton and ultimately Washington, James Madison, all say paper money is bound to depreciate. Paper money is a terrible idea, and one of the key things they did in the Constitution was prohibit the states from issuing paper money. None of us has South Carolina or Pennsylvania or North Carolina paper money. If they do, it's from 1861. But they banned the states from printing paper money because, and they always turn it to the example of Rhode Island, where you had a hyperinflation. And a couple other states also did have paper money that inflated. But lots of other states did print paper money during that period, and it did fine. You had neither inflation nor deflation. What you and I think would agree was equitable. And one of the states where that was the case, ironically, was New York, where Alexander Hamilton was in the legislature and said, don't print paper money. It'll massively We'll have runaway inflation, and it'll be a total ripoff for people who've lent out money because they'll get paid back with worthless paper money. He warned them and warned them not to do it. They did it anyway. And I have to give Hamilton credit for this. Hamilton said, you know what? I've got to admit, this paper money has worked out fine. That doesn't show up in the musical, but it should.
I don't think there's anything that is more either incomprehensible or boring to most people than monetary policy. So
yeah, it's both. But
let me summarize it this way then.
Make a rap out of it.
Yeah, that'd be difficult to do a rap about money. But be that as it may, let's just summarize then. Your position is that the elites, who did still to a great extent control many of the state legislatures, through both their fiscal policies, that is raising taxes, and through their effective monetary policies to the extent they refused to create paper money and they insisted upon hard currency, which was increasingly scarce, through both their fiscal and monetary policies, they were squeezing the common folk. And the common folk knew it. The common folk were trying to reform. The common folk occasionally got those reforms through, as in the state of New York. And it did not lead to financial Armageddon. It was actually something that balanced the competing economic forces. And then when the Constitution was adopted, the big people, the money people, they won.
That's right. And the reason that the elite felt they had to write the Constitution was that they did sincerely believe that the democracy had failed. That is, what I'm going to say right now is not my belief, but I think I'm channeling Madison and Hamilton. Mm-hmm. Watch them when I say this. They said, we tried it your way, and it didn't work. That is, we tried letting farmers have a lot of power, and they used that power to persuade their state legislators, almost all of whom were elected every single year. They used that power to get their legislators to give them tax relief and also debtor relief, and most of all, paper money. And the Madisons and Washingtons and Hamiltons believed paper money was a disaster, even if it really wasn't. They believed it was a disaster, and it was in a few states like Rhode Island.
But only in extreme cases. But that leads to a really interesting question, Woody. If the elites got together in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787, and if they came up with these restrictions on the state's ability to alleviate these financial problems for the common folk, as they did, how in the world did ratification ever occur?
That is a great and tough question. The short answer to that, to me, is that ironically, the Constitution brought ordinary farmers tax relief. It's paying off the speculators because the federal government now has the power to levy taxes directly, and it can now do so and then use that money to pay off the speculators. But because we now have a customs union, that is, the 13 states have turned over to the federal government their power to collect both import taxes and export taxes in the ports, the federal government can now collect a ton of money in the ports. It helped that there were bad harvests and then the French Revolution in Europe, so American trade really took off in the 1790s. And since American trade is doing so well, the American Treasury is pulling in a lot of money through the ports. So,
but that's a post hoc justification, though. That may be what happened in the 1790s, and I'm not going to dispute you. You're the historian here. But that doesn't tell me why a ratification debate that takes place in the summer of 1788 is actually going to support the elite position, the hard money policies, and the curbs on democracy. How did those ratification was done by conventions? It was done with a fairly broad franchise. So how did that happen?
Well, let me make a point about that, and then we can mm-hmm. talk about some of the other factors. But I know that people supporting the Constitution did make the case that I just made to you, that if we have a customs union, a federal taxing authority, most of the tax revenue can come in through the ports, and we can reduce the taxes that farmers pay. So they were already anticipating that, and a lot of people believe that.
So they anticipated what actually happened.
Who made that case, would say.
So they actually did anticipate that what happened in the 1790s.
That was definitely part of the rhetoric in favor of the Constitution. Vote for the Constitution and you'll get a tax cut.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with University of South Carolina Professor Woody Holton all about his book, Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution. And we were just discussing the question of how you got ordinary people to support something that really sounded kind of like an elite proposition. After the break, we'll come back and we'll finish our conversation with Woody, so stick around. To Your Weekly Constitutional. Now it's time to finish our conversation with University of South Carolina Professor Woody Holton, all about his book, Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution. Before the break, we were talking about the fact that there, then as now, there was sort of a schism between the people at the top, the people like Madison and Hamilton and Washington and all those other people whose names we know, the elites, if you will, and then the common folk on the other end. And there was a problem there. So how in the world did those elite guys convince the rest of the unwashed to vote for the Constitution? Turns out it had something to do with taxes.
Between you and me, I think a lot of people making that case for the Constitution were, they thought they were BSing. They thought, well, I'll say whatever I got to say. Thing adopted. But they turned out to be better prophets than they realized. Now, there were some other factors in the adoption of the Constitution, like the state legislatures themselves. The ratifying conventions were tilted in favor of the coast. This was long before the principle of one person, one vote. And so, for instance, in South Carolina, the vast majority of the delegates in the convention were from the Charleston area, even though about half the people at the time of the free white voters lived in the western part of the state. So malapportionment was a factor. There was a lot of lying on both sides. Most of the newspapers, though, were controlled by the Federalists, and so they benefited more from their lies than the Anti-Federalists did from their lies against it. But I do think that that many farmers, and actually if you look at the map, the West tended to vote against the Constitution, the East tended to vote for it, with exceptions. But in general, I think many farmers made a very rational calculation that, you know, I hate to see those speculators get all this money, and I hate to see paper money banned because you need paper money sometimes, but I'm desperate. I can see how the Constitution's going to cut my direct taxes, and those port taxes are so much less painful because there's money in circulation in the cities. I'm going to go ahead and support the Constitution. But here's where the problem for me comes in is when the historians get into it, they extract these lines from people like Hamilton and really the thing that sums up my book is that phrase that Hamilton used at the Constitutional Convention when he was defining the problem. The reason they were at Philadelphia was excess of democracy, the country suffering from an excess of democracy. But here's the surprise about that three-word phrase. Before Hamilton used that phrase at the Constitutional Convention, Elbridge Gerry had already used exactly the same phrase to describe the problem. He was from Massachusetts. He'd just come through Shays' Rebellion. And he was just as convinced as Madison, his fellow delegate to the Constitutional Convention, that we've got a problem of excess of democracy. And what makes that interesting to me is that Gerry ended up opposing the Constitution, primarily because it didn't have a Bill of Rights. But what it means is the whole spectrum of people at that convention, I don't want to talk in terms of left and right, but if we're on a yardstick, Hamilton, who's at zero in terms of better put him at 36, who's the whole spectrum of people at the Constitutional Convention, from Hamilton, who's at 36 on the yardstick in support of the Constitution, to Gerry at the opposite end of the spectrum at zero, there was a consensus. As diverse as the Founding Fathers were in many ways, there was a consensus among almost everybody there that we were suffering from an excess of democracy. And I would say they were absolutely sincere about that. I disagree with Charles Beard in that I don't think they were opposing this so-called excess of democracy out of greed. They weren't trying to line their own pockets or make profits for themselves. Some of them were bond speculators. Elbert Gerry was, for instance. But that's not why those who supported the Constitution did, and all but three of the eventual people there did support it. The reason they supported it is they really believed in this notion of an excess of democracy leading to a terrible credit rating both for the state and local governments and for the nation as a whole. So they were sincere about that. And I won't go so far as to say that I think they were wrong, but I think it was at least debatable whether we were suffering from an excess of democracy or a shortage of democracy.
And so essentially you're saying we adopted our entire structure of government based upon what is arguably a false premise, at least an arguable premise. Does that mean you think we have a bad constitution?
No. I think you used the exact right phrase, and I wish you'd been around when I was writing on Early Americans, because we adopted our whole frame of government based on an arguable premise, this premise that ordinary people can't govern themselves. And the reason I say go from that to saying that it's still a great constitution, because right away Americans began altering that constitution. We started this conversation by my pointing out that the authors of the Constitution did not give us gun rights or freedom of religion or freedom from unlawful search and seizure. They didn't give us any of those rights. And the Constitution, if they had stayed by that position, the Constitution would have failed of ratification. The way we got the Constitution, the way they got the Constitution ratified, was by promising after ratification to amend it to protect these certain rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and the others. So already by 1791, when the Bill of Rights was ratified, the Constitution had started to move in a different direction. It was no longer a creditor's constitution, or I like to call it a capitalist constitution, in that it's meant to attract capital to the American economy. No longer an anti-democratic constitution, it's a liberty constitution. But of course, as you know, the Bill of Rights only applied to Congress, not to the state legislatures. So what really makes, to me, the U.S. Constitution an underdog's constitution are the Reconstruction Amendments, which apply especially the 14th, which applies the Bill of Rights to the states, and the amendments, the 19th Amendment, which enfranchises that other half of the population.
The majority of the population, those people we call women.
Yeah, that's right.
But let me just, again, I'm just going to try to recast this then. So it looked as if the creditors and the elites won a great victory, at least with the first seven articles of the Constitution that were ratified in 1788. But you're pointing out that even during the ratification debates, the proponents of that Constitution had to give in on the issue of a Bill of Rights. And so there was already an amendment process in motion, one that we've talked about in the show many times, about how Madison took the lead on it and honored the promise, and what would have happened perhaps if he hadn't. As you've pointed out, there would have been a failure. And so already we were moving in a different direction, not one that was just here to suppress the common folk, but one that was here in many respects, at least as of 1791, when the Bill of Rights was adopted, it was going to protect individual rights of both the elites and the common folk. And that process then has continued subsequently in our constitutional history.
That's right. Starting in 1788 and going right up to the 27th Amendment, which limits Congress's ability to raise its own salary, the most recent one, through that whole process, we Americans have transformed the Constitution into something that the Founding Fathers had no intention of writing. And that is, we've turned it into an underdog's Constitution.
And so this democracy stuff may not be so bad after all.
Yes. That's the message. That's a pretty cool message.
It's a pretty cool message. Now, I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this before, but I'm going to go ahead and throw a question out there, and you can feel free to tackle it or not as you wish. Do you see any modern significance to this? We're in the midst of a presidential election. It's an extraordinary presidential election. Many people are saying at least on the Republican side, and oh no, I guess also on the Democratic side, that there's a great wave of populism, which is a somewhat pejorative term that could also be said there's been a wave of democracy lately. Is this at all a continuation of what we saw back in the day?
I'm a historian, not a politician.
Of course.
But it's a fun question, so mm-hmm. let me try. I will say it has saddened me to see the word populism be perverted into associated with people like George Wallace and Donald Trump. That mm-hmm. is, populism is used so many times now as getting the white majority, which is just barely a majority these days, riled up and fearful of people of different religions and different ethnic groups and different nationalities. That certainly has happened. I'm not denying that part of our history, but populism began as a movement, as you know, in the 1880s to make our government more responsive to the people. For instance, they were demanding that the U.S. Senate be elected by the people rather than by the state legislatures, mm-hmm. which is something that did happen in 1913, the same year as Charles Beard's book. And the other thing the populists were demanding was paper money. So there's an ongoing debate in American history. It was too late to have state-level paper money by the time the populists came along in the 1880s, but they were raising some of the same issues that farmers had raised in the 1780s about are we going to have an economy that there's enough money in circulation that we're going to not have deflation.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, I would say, maybe I'm just revealing my own partisan bias, that the proper descendant of Daniel Shays and of Herman Husband and of the populists of the 1880s is not Trump. It's Bernie Sanders in his railing against the 1%. Whether you agree with that railing or not, he's really got a lot in common with his fellow New Englander, Daniel Shays.
Yeah, the term populism is sometimes used across the spectrum, and people will equate a Trump supporter, for example, with a Sanders supporter. There's an argument to be made. I mean, they're both people who think that there's something fundamentally wrong with the nation, and they both want to fix it. But if you go much beyond that very broad...
There's
a lot of difference. And in fact, I think I agree with you. And I'm, again, we're not partisan here. I'm simply trying to be an observer of the constitutional scene as it unfolds. I think that you're right. I think the rhetoric that we hear coming from the Sanders camp is quite consistent with what you've described as the Shays Rebellion people and the people who wanted paper money back in the 1780s. And periodically throughout our constitutional history, it's a battle of the common person against their perceived enemies at the top of the economic scale.
And yes, and this is an overly crude generalization, but one way to deal with the term populism, which has acquired this negative connotation for so many people, is to distinguish between race populism and class populism. That I think it's fair to say that Bernie Sanders is participating in class populism. And I don't want to be partisan by making that accusation about Trump, so we can go back to someone that he's often compared to, George Wallace, was clearly engaging in race populism.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can't come up with another word for one of them, we can at least modify populism to distinguish between class populism of a Daniel Shays or a Bernie Sanders versus the race populism of George Wallace and maybe some people in the current scheme.
Well, to coin a phrase, not. What goes around comes around. There's really, in some sense, nothing new in constitutional history. The old arguments continue to swirl about us, even in 2016. And I think this sheds a fascinating light on all of this. So I know your book has been out for a number of years, but I'm sure it's still available, right, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, they got it in paperback. Thanks for helping me plug it. It's called Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution.
Unruly Americans and the Origins of the Constitution by Woody Holton, Holton. And people can get that in their local bookstores as well as on Amazon and other online outlets, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, Woody Holton of the University of South Carolina, formerly of the University of Richmond, which is where we first met, and where you used to be able to listen to my show on the air. And we're going to have to get down to South Carolina and find ourselves a good...
I know. We got to get it on SCETV, because once you get here, you get the whole state. And I would sure love
well, that,
to...
Well, that's the quid pro quo, then, Woody.
Podcast to get it.
We just plugged your book. Now, you got to go ahead and plug the show to your local NPR affiliate or your local public radio station down there.
I'm going to be down there on Thursday, so I'll get it done.
Plug the show. All right. Thanks, Woody. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks, man.
We've been out here for days following Daniel Shays to the arsenal in Springfield, Massachusetts. They call us regulators. We're frontiersmen and traitors. They tax the poor and give it to the rich. We didn't fight a revolution for this. With a spruce of hemlock, we'll carry our flintlock all the way to Boston. We'll burn the whole town like they did at Jamestown, Nathaniel Bacon crossing. We fought at Saratoga and Ticonderoga. We got the British gone, but now we're left with this. We didn't fight a revolution for this. Just a weak confederation, 13 countries torn apart from the rest. We need a constitution to finish this revolution and tie the North and the South to the East and the West. Get Washington and Hamilton and Madison and Mason.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my buddy Woody Holton from the University of South Carolina for sharing with us that marvelous discussion about his book, Unruly Americans, The Origins of the Constitution. It was published several years ago, but it's still out there, so you can find it in your local bookstore or on Amazon. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, because guess what? All of us common folk are a part of it.